and original works of art, located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square, downtown Urbana. Information at 344-2444.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of the show, we will have a medical topic for you. We'll talk a little bit about digestive health, something that we have done, I think, at least once a year now over the past few years. Throughout the year, we have a variety of physicians on the program. We have a pediatrician. We have an OBGYN. We have a family practice doctor who are here fairly regularly. But there are also certain things that we like to try to get to at least once a year with people who specialize in particular parts of the body. And our guest this morning in this hour of the show is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist, which means she deals with all of the various parts of the digestive tract. And if you have questions, I know that she will do her best to give you an answer. Whenever we have a physician here on the program, I always try to start out just cautioning people, reminding them that obviously we cannot do diagnosis over the telephone. There's a limit to what we can do here, but we also do these shows to try to help add to your health knowledge, give you an opportunity to ask some questions, and then, of course, if you have concerns, you need to pursue that with your own doctor or someone who can see you. But this is a place you can start and ask some basic questions. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455, that's Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
One thing that we have talked about quite a bit last couple of times you've been here, and maybe I'll start and we can ask some questions about it once again, because it is something that we hear more about, and it's a problem that it seems a growing number of people have, is acid reflux. The kind of thing that people describe as heartburn. The thing is, some people have it every once in a while, and some people have it all the time and take medication that's designed to help reduce their production of acid. And these are medications that we know a lot of people take, and they're actually now pretty heavily advertised to people, and as now are a lot of medications. So maybe let me ask you a basic question for anybody who's really not quite sure what reflux is and where you cross that line between kind of garden variety heartburn that maybe almost everybody would say, I experience this occasionally, and two, the problem where you're getting into reflux disease and it's more than just an occasional problem and you might want to treat it.
Okay. Reflux problems, first of all, are incredibly common. And it's just simply a matter of acid coming up into the esophagus more than what is considered normal, and there are standards set for how much acid should actually come into the esophagus and be considered as normal. But you can have pain even from a normal amount of acid being coming up to the esophagus. If people have heartburn, substernal burning sensations a couple times a month, that's not a big deal. When it becomes a problem almost every day where you're constantly taking over-the-counter antacids with borderline control, that becomes a significant problem and should probably be treated differently.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of medications that are available, there obviously are antacids. There are what used to be kind of the standard medication that are now available over the counter, and that's things like Zantac and Pepcid, and there are others. Those that used to be prescription only medicines are now, you can just walk into the drugstore and you can buy them. And then now we have another group of medicines, things that are called proton pump inhibitors, and that's something like Prilosec, which actually now is also available over-the-counter.
Right.
There are some of those that are still by prescription only that are essentially the same, a very similar class of medicines. The only difference is the dosage. Is there now the standard is the standard now the proton pump inhibitor? You think that that's a better medicine, works better than the old medicines like Pepcid and Zantac?
It depends on the severity of the disease. If you have an occasional heartburn problem once a month, a couple times a month, and you want to take something to help you right now, then either antacids or the histamine blockers such as Zantac, Tagamet, Pepcid, those can all be taken at that time. You'll get relief very quickly thereafter. The proton pump inhibitors, such as Prilosec, and I believe Prevacid is coming over the counter very soon now as well, and then there are prescription aspects of those as well, do not have an effect, maximum effect, for 24 to 48 hours after you take them. So if you take them as needed, you're not doing yourself a whole lot of favor until the next day. And you don't have maximum effect probably for a couple weeks. So those are need to be taken a little bit differently than the other medicines, and it depends on the symptoms and the severity of the symptoms and frequency of the symptoms as to what you should be taking.
Mm-hmm. The people who make Prilosec, not that far before, I think they pretty much knew this drug, they were going to lose their patent for the drug, and chances are it was going to go
right
over the counter. I'm sure they're still making a lot of money on it because it's a very popular drug. They introduced a very similar kind of drug, which is now only available by prescription.
All right.
Is there really very much difference between those two medicines?
No, there's not. There is, I believe, an amino acid group that was attached to the Prilosec version. It works just as well as Prilosec. They doubled the dose, so you may get a healing rate that's a little bit faster, but overall the medicine is the same. It's just a little bit of a higher dose, and overall it has about the same effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. There are some surgeries that people do to try to improve the condition, reduce the amount of acid that comes up into the esophagus by working on, in a sense, doing something mechanical at that point where the stomach and the esophagus come together. Because apparently one of the things that happens is that there's a valve there that's supposed to keep the acid from coming up into the esophagus. And for some number of reasons, and I guess maybe we don't exactly know why, it doesn't work right.
Right.
So there are some things that can be done to try to either tighten that up, do something to try to address that problem in a mechanical kind of way. And there are some that's really an invasive, and it's a serious thing. And there's some kind of procedures that are much less invasive that don't actually involve opening the person up to do it. How well have any of these things worked to address the problem?
Well, the gold standard for reflux procedures has always been considered a fundoplication surgical procedure, and the most common is called a Nissen, which was described by Dr. Nissen, I believe. And it simply wraps the top of the stomach around the bottom of the esophagus and gives increased pressure there. Now, it doesn't relax anymore. It's not a muscle that opens and closes, but it then protects from acid coming up into the esophagus. That originally was an open procedure, open surgery. There was a large incision. It was along the side of the chest and abdomen, because it's a difficult area to get at to be able to do the surgery. It was a very big surgery, and recovery time was painful, and it took a long time to get over that. They are now doing that surgery fairly routinely, laparoscopically, so very small incisions, and are actually doing it quite well with very good results and with fairly good long-term results as well. So I think that's probably the new gold standard to which to compare to, if we have any. And those usually will last and stay in place several years, 10 years at least. Sometimes, things do come apart or they fall again and open up. But for the most part, they tend to last longer. There are now some endoscopic procedures that are being done that have had good effectiveness. We have absolutely no long-term results from those because they are fairly new. They work at least as well as the proton pump inhibitors do in controlling symptoms. Whether they actually control the amount of reflux that is occurring or whether they are decreasing the sensitivity in the lower esophagus to the reflux that does occur is some of the question with some of these procedures. All of them try to increase the pressures in the lower esophageal sphincter area, that muscle in the lower esophagus, to try to decrease acid coming up. Some of them are injection procedures. Some of them are actually burning procedures where you're scarring down that area to try to decrease how much opening occurs over time. And some of them actually are almost an endoscopic surgery where things eclipse or sutures are put into place to close that area down more.
Mm-hmm. Do people who have these surgeries, do they continue to take medication?
With the endoscopic procedures, it's a little bit dependent on which procedure is done for which situation. Many of those people get by with less medicines, some without any. I don't think I can quote any exact percentages. With the original surgical numbers, with indocin fund application, the open surgeries and laparoscopic, the medicine literature, and I think this is a little bit on the low side compared to the surgical literature, suggests that at least 80% of those people are much improved and have significant improvement to the point that they're taking very few medicines or none at all, whereas about 10% have, there it's a little bit too tight and they have a little problem swallowing, and another 10% are, it's a little bit too loose, and so they're kind of where they were at before.
We have a couple of callers here. We'd be very happy to take questions, and let me introduce again our guest. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She is a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the digestive system and all of the things that can cause problems, and if you have questions, give us a call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Roanoke, Illinois, on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes, this is Rod Wagenbach.
Yeah.
Ronald.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if, like, heartburn and diarrhea, are there any connection there?
Well, there depends on the person to a certain extent. Any stimulation of the GI tract can induce a lot of movement. And irritation from heartburn certainly could conceivably cause much more movement and then induce a diarrhea problem. The other thing to think about is some of the medicines, particularly the proton pump inhibitors such as Prilosec, Prevacid, et cetera, about 5 to 10% of the time can also cause diarrhea problems as a side effect of the medicine.
Because sometimes, you know, I can...
Okay, I think we're going to go on to another caller here. Let's go on line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
It was quite a surprise a while back to discover that some ulcer seemed to be caused by a bacterial infection. It was usually considered a physiology or a mechanical problem. Keeping up with that, are there other disorders, acid reflux on down, that are currently thought to be associated with one form or another of bacterial, fungal, or other infections? I just want to hear you discuss that topic as a new way of looking at disorders, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
That's an interesting question there. I think there are a lot more focus going on as to different disorders actually being caused by infectious diseases, including even coronary artery disease. I mean, there are some theories out there that they may be at least partially infectious in etiology and in cause. As far as the GI tract, certainly there is evidence that many ulcers may be caused, or at least recurring ulcers, caused by a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori. And if you can diagnose that, get rid of it, the rate of recurrent ulceration goes way down. And therefore, of course, symptoms from that as well. We're seeing more and more ulcers, however, occurring without that bacteria being around now. I think we've probably done a pretty good job in clearing a lot of those ulcers from the bacteria as the cause, but now we're running into more of the problems are now considered more acid-related only, or some other factors that we have not identified. It's interesting that there are several papers that suggest if you get rid of the Helicobacter, which actually suppresses acid production, which is kind of odd since it seems to aid in causing ulcers, that you may increase potential for reflux disease because now there's actually more acid being produced and more of a potential for reflux. Other etiologists, since we're talking about reflux disease that we think are also important. It's not just bacterial involvement, but also decreased secretion clearing from the esophagus, which may be motility disturbance or the mucus, not the correct type of mucus being secreted into the esophagus and therefore causing more problems when even normal acid does come into the esophagus that's just not being cleared. And then you have more symptoms and then breakdown. Other than that, I'm not really aware of any too much other bacterial causes of other common things in the GI tract. There are some theories that irritable bowel syndrome may be more of a bacterial-related problem, but I've not seen anything that's very straightforward with that.
Yeah. Well, as the caller suggests, I think, and this is not exactly a new development, but the last big new thing that probably came along in terms of treatment for ulcer disease was this understanding that in some people, they apparently had this bacteria, and that once you'd establish that, you'd have to make sure you test for it and that they actually do have it, then part of your treatment might be antibiotics to knock out this bacteria.
Right.
So now, though, it sounds like are you always going to test for that? And if you find the H. pylori, then how do you decide if you're going to use antibiotic as part of your therapy?
I think if it's tested for, most people believe they're pretty much committed to treating for it. Otherwise, why did you test for it, I suppose?
Yeah.
There is also a question whether Helicobacter may be a carcinogenic, a cancer-producing agent, and has been implicated as a possible agent in stomach cancer formation. That can be debated a whole lot, and it probably is not the cause of most stomach cancers, but certainly has been looked at quite carefully. And in fact, the World Health Organization does consider it a very high potential carcinogenic agent. So certainly we do treat for it if it's checked for. If there is an ulcer there, if there is breakdown in the stomach lining, you should check for Helicobacter if it has not been checked for recently. If there is no breakdown in the lining, there's no history of ulcer problems, there is not a fantastic reason to be checking for it in that situation. There are a lot of patients that have something called non-ulcer dyspepsia, which is more or less irritable bowel involving more of the upper GI tract. And they often will have a burning-type symptom, so everyone thinks, well, that's acid-related. If you check for Helicobacter in those patients, a certain percentage will be positive. But studies have shown that if you go ahead and treat those patients, there's not very consistent response to getting rid of the bacteria and resolution of their symptoms.
If you went out and you just constructed a representative sample of people and you just tested everybody for the presence of the H. pylori, and then you took those people who tested positive and out of the people you said to them, well, how are you feeling? Yeah, you got any problems? Are you going to actually find people where the bacteria is present who are asymptomatic, who would
certainly
not say, they'd say, oh, I feel okay. I don't have any.
Yes.
I don't think I have any problems.
Yeah. In fact, most of those patients would not have any symptoms.
Yeah.
Gastroenterologists have a much higher rate of being infected with Helicobacter, actually having it present if you test them for it. But our rate of ulcer disease or other GI symptomatology is not higher than anyone else's.
And you've picked that up from your patients?
Yes, exactly. Oh. GI nurses as well.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, we have some other callers here. Let's go on to, I think we have a caller here on our toll-free line in Bradley, line number 4.
Yes. I had intermittent pain in my left chest, and the doctor thought it might be heartburn and thought I could try Pepcid. I wondered, and it's been so intermittent I haven't done anything, why can you get heartburn just on one side?
Well, I guess that's
I lay on my left side at night.
Right. That may be the art of medicine. Not everyone reads the textbook before they come to see us, and everyone has different symptoms from different problems. Heartburn can present, or I should say acid reflux can present very differently. Some people have chest pain, and they constantly are going in because everyone's concerned it's their heart, and they do not present very typically. And you make sure the heart is okay, and then you move on. And sometimes simply putting people on an acid-controlling medicine for a period of time, because it can be very intermittent, will prove that, yes, this must be acid-related because I'm better 6 months later having taken this medicine than I was 6 months ago. It's not very straightforward. Why some people will have only one-sided pain and not central, which is where it should be happening because that's where the disease process is actually occurring, is not certain. Our internal organs, our GI tract, really everything inside, does not have very good pinpoint sensitivity like, for example, our finger would, where if you poked it, you knew exactly where that pin is poking you. If you go into your intestinal tract, it'll be an area that hurts as opposed to one where the problem actually is. A perfect example is appendicitis, which will also often give abdominal pain around the belly button to begin with before it actually moves over to where the appendix actually sits, which is usually in the right lower area. And that's just the innervation, the nerve makeup sensitivities of our abdomen.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other calls are certainly welcome. Our guest this morning is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Krista Clinic. We're talking about digestive health. And if you've got questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I expect that probably human beings have been dealing with heartburn for a long time. It didn't just start recently. But that recently it does seem to be we have increasing numbers of people who are complaining about it, who are going to their doctor because of the symptoms, and who are taking some kind of medication, either over-the-counter or by prescription. So that makes you wonder, well, what's going on here? Do we really have more heartburn, and do we really have more reflux? Is it because it's getting attention and we have medicines for it and they're being marketed directly to patients? Is that what's going on?
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, I think everyone is becoming much more aware of it as drug companies advertise on television with these new agents. People go, well, yes, I guess I do have a little bit of heartburn. I guess I'll go to my physician and see what he thinks about this medicine. The other major factor, especially with reflux disease, is the growing amount of obesity problems that are occurring in the United States. And that is a significant contribution to the reflux problems as well.
Yeah. Well, it does seem to be the case that that's one of the first things if you have an individual who has that complaint and they go to the doctor. And if they are overweight, I think probably one of the first things the doctor will say, well, I would suggest that you lose weight. And then apparently there are some people who, with a combination of modifying their diet, losing weight, maybe raising the head of their bed, can actually get significant relief short of medication. And then, of course, then that's also you can also take that next step and use the medication too.
Right. So it's much easier to pop a pill than it is to change your behavior.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we've gone as a society. We also are a society that now there's a new Starbucks in town, all the coffee shops. Caffeine is a chemical that lowers the pressures in that muscle and lower esophagus, and it precipitates more heartburn problems. We are definitely a fast food cola society. Anything that has caffeine in it can certainly increase those problems.
Yeah. So. And alcohol, too?
Alcohol does decrease that sphincter pressure a little bit. It's probably more of a direct irritant more than anything as far as reflux problems are concerned.
Okay. A couple of callers here. The next is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is actually an immune disorder, but it affects the digestive tract. I don't know if that's something that you would deal with. I have a relative who's discovered that she has a wheat allergy, and it's also called celiac disease.
Yes.
And I got a cookbook out of the library and was reading that it affects the small villi in the digestive tract get damaged, and it reduces the absorbing ability of the digestive tract and can cause things like osteoporosis. And from talking to other people, I gather it's one of these diseases or syndromes or whatever that masquerades as lots of different things and is really underdiagnosed. And I was wondering if you could just talk generally about it to other people who may not have heard about it and myself.
I'm going to have you come in and talk about it, I think, because you sound like you've read up on it pretty well. Yes, celiac disease, gluten-sensitive enteropathy, as the same type of disease, is considered a wheat allergy, and it's the gluten protein itself in the wheat and in other grains that produces the problem. It has a direct inflammatory effect on the small intestine and causes shortening of the villi, which are responsible for absorption in the small intestine, and thereby can cause some other problems. It has been much under-recognized in the United States. It used to be thought that this was a problem more in Great Britain, particularly Ireland is where they thought was the largest population. But we now realize that most anyone of Western European heritage probably has a much higher potential of having this problem. It can be everything from a very mild disorder to, actually, I should say even less than that. It can be nothing. You can have the disease but not have symptoms from it, to severe problems with severe malabsorption and malnutrition, and to even death. And this has occurred certainly, especially in younger children, where it was not recognized. It is being pushed at, I think, a lot of conferences. I know in the GI conferences that I'm going to and internal medicine conferences, they are really pushing this so that physicians are more aware that it needs to be checked. It can cause diarrhea problems, certainly. It can be a very intermittent problem. Probably many patients that have had irritable bowel syndrome complaints may actually have a mild celiac disease. And it needs to be checked for, and probably many more patients than we have been in the past. It can cause some mild abnormalities in liver tests. It can cause rashes. It can cause actually joint aches. It can cause a lot of host of problems, and unfortunately very vague problems. It can cause anemia problems. It's one of the things that we routinely check for now in our patients when we're doing endoscopies for anemia, that they also have celiac testing done.
I was amazed at just in being with family over vacation, how many different things have wheat in them. There was one yogurt. She couldn't eat Breyer's yogurt because it has modified food starch in it. Mm. I never paid attention to modified food starch. It's avoiding some of these allergies is really quite complicated. And you wonder how, if wheat has been in diets for so long in human evolution, you wonder how we've ended up with people who are allergic to it, and why. Does anybody know what triggers this?
No, the part of the interesting thing about this is it can be so variable in within a person's lifetime. I probably shouldn't use my own family, but I will. I have an aunt actually that has celiac disease that almost died from it as a child, at age 2. It was in post-World War II Europe, and she was taken care of. They diagnosed it, which surprised me very much. They didn't have a whole lot of food to go on, and so when she did get back home, it was kind of forgotten. They had to eat what they had, and she did fine until age 50, till no one knew anything about this anymore. Her parents were no longer around, and then suddenly at age 50, she starts having problems again, and it was re-diagnosed. But she'd had this all her life, but only had problems with it when she was a young child, and then again when she turned 50. So it makes it even more challenging and more interesting to look at what actually causes this to come on.
Well, thanks.
All right, thank you. To next caller, this is someone listening in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Hi, Dr. Nugent. I have a question about lactose intolerance.
Okay.
Which dairy products are safe to eat for people who have some sort of lactose intolerance? I've heard that some processed cheeses are okay and that yogurt is okay, but I'm not really sure why, if it's because of the cultures. And there's an ingredient called whey protein in a lot of things. I was wondering if that's dairy, if it contains lactose. And finally, if lactase tablets, which I've seen some people take, are helpful, or if it's better to just try to eliminate lactose from your diet.
Okay. I think a dietitian is going to be a little bit more astute than I am on this, but I certainly can give you some general guidelines. First of all, most of the block cheeses like cheddar cheese, Monterey Jack, the things you actually can have to cut with a knife, most of the lactose has been broken down in those products in the processing of the cheese. And those are supposed to be okay to eat, even if you do have lactose intolerance, whereas these naturally processed cheeses, many of the for example, French cheeses, brie and camembert, fresh mozzarella, those are supposed to be off limits because the lactose has not been broken down in those. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the mozzarella that you can actually cut up with a knife, and that process is probably okay to eat that. The yogurts are okay as long as that whey protein that you describe is not in them, because the whey does have lactose in it and therefore it becomes a problem. And whey is often used as a thickening agent. And for that reason, yogurts that are thickened with the whey should be off limits if you need to be on a strict lactose-free diet. Whereas many yogurts that do not use that are fine. So if it doesn't have that protein in it because of the lactase-producing bacteria that have an enzyme that breaks down the lactose in the yogurt, those other yogurts are fine, as is the same with frozen yogurts, again, as long as that whey protein is not there. Lactase tablets are probably fine in people that have mild lactose intolerance. I think people that have very severe lactose intolerance, it's not going to make up the difference. And a lot of those enzymes actually get broken down in the stomach before they even get to the small intestine, which is where they need to be effective. So I don't think they're very effective.
Okay. How do you know which type of bacteria is lactase producing?
Well, one key clue is lactobacillus.
Okay.
From the name you can tell. And that is what's used in yogurt cultures to break down the lactose.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll go to another caller, someone here on a cell phone, line 3. Hello.
Hi, I'd like to ask a question about gallstones. I'm curious if stress can cause an increase in the symptoms caused by gallstones and stomach pain.
I think stress can increase pain from anything myself. That's my idea on that. But it probably does not increase the problem itself of the stones. Stress causes adrenaline release, which is the same as epinephrine. That causes smooth muscle spasming, and that can all contribute towards GI or abdominal pain problems. So theoretically, yeah, stress could certainly increase pain from just about anything, and that seems to me a good chemical way of explaining that.
Okay, so it's possible if you're having a problem with gallstones and you take out the gallbladder that you could still have remaining problems that are just caused by stress in itself.
Yeah, and you actually bring up a good point. We see a lot of patients that have pain in the right side of their upper abdomen. And many patients do have gallstones that may not necessarily be causing a problem, but you do an ultrasound, the gallstones are found. Pain seems consistent with stones from that, and so the gallbladder is taken out. Sometime later, patients come back and they are having the same pain because it just happened not to be the gallstones. And irritable bowel syndrome is very common to present as pain in that right upper quadrant area, probably, well, again, theoretically, because the intestine takes a big curve in that area, the large intestine does. And so intuitively you think, well, if things are passing through and you have a spasm in the area, it's a tight curve, it just is going to hurt more. But that's a common problem. And certainly, again, the stress seems to increase intestinal spasming and movement and certainly can contribute towards more pain.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Sure. Thank you. Well, again, we have time for certainly some other questions. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist at Christie Clinic. We're talking about the digestive system and digestive issues. And if you have some kind of question, you can give us a call. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll free 800-222-9455. Certainly stress can manifest itself in all kinds of ways. And it seems that different people, it finds different ways to get them. But
exactly.
Probably a lot of people would say, you know, well, there's a definite relationship between stress and your stomach, or, you know, however you would describe your GI. Is there some particular reason why there seems to be this close relationship between stomach upset, digestive problems, and stress?
I think there is, and it's probably, I think it can be explained chemically very easily if we knew all the chemicals that were being released when stress occurs, and I don't think we know more than 1% of them, if even that much. I once saw an article, actually, that was from the New York Times, I believe, many years ago, that addressed this exact issue and why people say, well, my stress, I exhibit as symptoms from my gut. Other people say, well, it's in my head, I get headaches, et cetera. But they talked about the different chemical and hormonal releases that occurred in the GI tract normally, and there are just multitudes of chemicals, reactions that occur, and then add on the chemical reactions that occur in situations of stress, and we haven't even touched the iceberg trying to understand them.
Hmm. Okay. Well, let's talk with another caller here, someone in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hello. Hi. I have a question about Prevacid. I've been taking Prevacid since about last August, and I'm wondering about the long-term effects of this. In reading the documentation that comes with it, it seems that at least for 12 months, it's been studied, and there don't seem to be any problems, any particular problems for long-term use of that length. But I'm wondering about continuing beyond 12 months. And in particular, I've noticed, you know, recently there have been problems for heart disease with naproxen related with long-term use of that. And I was using that for about 5 years. And I've stopped using that, but so I just not too anxious to get into another problem. Find out down the road that long-term use of Prevacid is dangerous.
I understand the concern certainly of taking anything long-term. We're always a little bit concerned about that. But to date, and there have been many retrospective studies, especially in Europe, where the proton pump inhibitors such as Prevacid have been used many more years than they have been here, and they've certainly been used a long time here as well as in patients that have a very uncommon tumor called a gastrinoma, where there's excessive amounts of acid used. Those were the only medicines that could be used, and those patients were used very long term, and it does appear that they are safe to use even beyond a year and beyond 5 years, beyond 10 years. There, in the rats that originally were studied with these proton pump inhibitors, there was an increase of a very uncommon stomach tumor called a carcinoid, which we don't see very often. That was not seen in any of the other animals tested. It wasn't seen in mice, et cetera, and it has not been found to have an increased incidence in humans.
Yeah, I see. Now, is any of this dose-related? I've been taking the 30 milligram, and is also 15 milligram is a possible alternative, I see.
Yeah, most of the studies were done on the 30 milligram dose, and that's a medium dose. It's not a high dose. And
yeah.
If that controls your symptoms, I think that's as safe and probably more effective than the 15 milligram dose.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, let's go to Danville for another caller here on the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm curious, in an ad for a book on home remedies, they mentioned as a teaser that one should cure heartburn with some cider vinegar and water. And then you see something else that says, for the same thing, to do baking soda and water. Now, heartburn is an excess of acid. It would make sense that the baking soda approach would be more reasonable.
Oh, this is an interesting question, and the reason it's probably in a home remedy book is because it probably has had some excess for different people for different reasons. Traditionally, yes, baking soda is going to calm down acid. So if your heartburn is actually coming from an acid production problem, that will help and will probably help the symptoms. The interesting point is that our upper GI tract only has certain ways of producing symptoms. And so burning is a primary symptom, but it doesn't necessarily is not always caused by acid. So if you have other things going on, whether the stomach has not emptied, they're too full, the vinegar, the acid may actually help some people's symptoms. And all they can say is it's burning, but what the exact cause is may not be acid-related, which is why it may be effective in some patients. And I have had patients tell me that they have had good success with getting rid of their heartburn and burning symptoms by taking acid products such as, for example, lemon juice. And if it works, great.
So if there's if the stomach is relatively empty and there's too much acid, which is a normal cause for the heartburn symptoms, that either to reduce the amount of acid that you know by medication that is produced by the stomach, or neutralizing it in part with sodium bicarbonate would be the route to take.
Yeah, that would work as well as an antacid would. You're pretty much dealing with the same type thing.
Of course it would be an antacid. Well, okay, well, because we were discussing this about a week ago, and I was perplexed about the two seemingly disparate cures of adding more acid and adding a neutralizer. So thank you very much.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Is there any particular problem or problems associated with long-term use of antacids, just the, like Tums or Rolaids, the kind of stuff that you can just buy over the counter?
Right. Not overall, probably not. Tums does contain calcium. So patients that are more prone to, you know, getting kidney stones may need to be a little bit careful with that. Overall, it does not seem to be a problem. Of course, it's promoted for retarding osteoporosis. That's been part of their ads as well.
Mm-hmm.
Magnesium, which often many of the antacids are magnesium-based, such as Mylanta, Maalox, and they... Magnesium is a very good diuretic or cathartic agent, so it will can actually cause diarrhea if you use it a lot. If you use it a lot, that can then cause low potassium levels. So it's something to at least think about. If used occasionally, even long-term, it's not going to be a problem. Other antacids, and I forget some of the brand names, are actually aluminum-based, and they actually can cause constipation problems if they're used a lot. Alternagel is an example with that. I believe Gaviscon is also aluminum-based. But there's also been a question of whether if there's too much aluminum absorption that can deposit in the brain, cause dementia problems. So there are some concerns, certainly, with long-term use. If people are having to use an antacid that much for control of heartburn from reflux symptoms, for example, they should probably be on another agent.
Okay. We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 5 minutes left. One thing I want to make sure that we touch on, at least really quickly, is colon cancer, just because it continues to be a very common cancer in the United States, and also because it's a cancer that's very treatable if you can get, you know, detect it as soon as you possibly can.
Right.
So now what are for in terms of and it's also something that you generally know you're pretty much not going to see in people much before they get to be 50. So there's a certain point in a person's life in which it's one of the standard things that physicians will want to do. They will want to start screening in various kinds of ways. So what are now the basic recommendations?
Okay, there are still three basic recommendations for low risk. The average patient that has no increased risk factors for colon cancer formation, that somewhere between the age of 45 and 50, and 50 is fine, should have either a sigmoidoscopy, which is a scoping exam of the left side of the colon, or a sigmoidoscopy with barium enema, or a colonoscopy. If the sigmoidoscopy is chosen, then they should also have stool card testing for microscopic blood. That should be done on a yearly basis, and then the sigmoidoscopy should be repeated every 3 to 5 years thereafter, as long as those cards remain negative.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, you can do a sigmoidoscopy with a barium enema, which then will evaluate the entire colon to a pretty good extent, but that should be repeated every 5 years, again, as long as the yearly hemocult and the stool card testing remains negative. The other alternative, which I think many people are going to because they feel maybe it might be a little bit of a better exam, is to do the colonoscopy, which is done with sedation. The entire colon is looked at, and if there's nothing found, that can be repeated. Current recommendations are for every 10 years. There are not current recommendations that any stool card testing be performed in those 10 years. I think most gastroenterologists, as humans, feel that it'd be a good idea at some point to start repeating those stool card testing, maybe 5 years out. I've heard kind of bantered about conferences to start doing that on a yearly basis. And again, as long as that stays negative, every 10 years should be fine.
Hmm. Well, is there much consensus as to how much, when you do this, how much of the colon you want to look at, whether it's pretty much okay just to look at the smaller part of it, and that's the one that you don't have to put the person under sedation to do. You do that in the office, the person's awake. It's not the most comfortable thing, but you can live. And the other one where it's a procedure where you look at the whole thing. I mean, is there much consensus about, do we want to look at everything? Do we just want to look at part of it?
I think most people feel that they would like to look at all of it. The reason that sigmoidoscopies came out as the original screening process was because most people that had right-sided colon cancers had polyps on the left side of their colon. so that if you did a sigmoidoscopy, you would find the polyps. Therefore, you then qualify for a colonoscopy, and you're going to find any significant lesions on the right side. The reason I think more and more people are moving towards full colon examinations, however, is because some recent studies are suggesting that more right colon lesions are being found without left-sided lesions. And therefore, if we just do a sigmoidoscopy, we're not going to realize there's something on the other side. The stool card testing is not perfect by a long shot, but it's cheap and easy to do. And if done on a yearly basis, we'll pick up most problems on the right colon. So that's why that's still considered an okay standard of care for screening purposes.
Okay. Let's get at least one more caller. We have someone here on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Doctor, I'm calling about my wife. She's had what I would term a sluggish colon for about 50 years. About 20 years ago, she only gained relief by having a colonic irrigation. And then since then, she had been treating the condition with herbal laxatives. And about a year ago, I got her to have a colonoscopy. And there was no constriction or knotting of the colon. But the gastroenterologist was able to determine during the colonoscopy that there was excessive use of laxatives. And he put her on a medication. I forgot the name of it. I would know it if you said it.
Zelnorm?
No. But it got so bad that whenever she would eat a meal, she would feel terrible. And this medication relieved it. But I was wondering about the long-term effects and the possibility of weaning off of that medication.
Okay. Does Bentyl, dicyclamine, Levsyn, hyoscyamine, do any of those sound familiar?
I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing you. I'm on a cell phone.
Oh, that's okay. Zelnorm is not it, because that would have been my first thought.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. Zelnorm, that is it.
Okay.
That is it.
All right. First of all, what the physician saw during the colonoscopy is something called melanosis coli, and it's actually staining of the colon wall from dyes that are present in stimulant laxatives. It's not seen with osmotic laxatives such as milk of magnesia, things that actually draw water to the colon for movement. And there's thought that the more you take of those stimulant laxatives, the less normal movement you're going to have, to the point that you're just not going to have any movement at all. The Zelnorm is a serotonin receptor agonist, meaning it promotes serotonin levels, and it stimulates movement in the colon. It has been heavily advertised on TV for constipation, predominant irritable bowel syndrome, and for this situation is wonderful. I don't believe that we have any long-term results from Zelnorm. However, the results that we do have show that it seems to be very effective and very useful and very safe, even for long-term use, and has been actually been used in other aspects, including a sluggish GI tract, even higher up from other health problems such as diabetes, scleroderma, etc. So it is being used in other situations. I know it's approved for use for 8 weeks, but at recent conferences they're saying they're using it long-term and have not seen any ill effects.
I see. Yeah, her gastroenterologist said that she'd be on it for at least a year.
Yeah, and that makes sense, and I believe that's safe. I don't think there's any problems with doing that.
Is there any hope of the musculature being, like, retrained to have proper movement without the stimulation of the Zelnorm?
Yeah, our theory is if you quit stimulating the colon with stimulant laxatives, that eventually it will start to move again, but it's probably taken her 50 years to get where she is. And
yeah,
it may
almost
take 50 years for it to get back. And she probably has some inherent slowness of the movement anyway, which is why she got there to begin with.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. We are just about the point where we're going to have to stop. Just real quick, as we were talking about cancer before, we were talking about the recommendations for screening as in terms of prevention, the kinds of things that you can do. We're still, the basic things we're talking about is trying to cut down on fat in the diet and make sure you have a good amount of fiber in your diet.
Yes, those are probably the primary things. There are also some recent articles that within the last few years suggesting that certain calcium products may be helpful in decreasing polyp or slowing down polyp growth, Also, aspirin, good old aspirin, is out there too as having shown to decrease the rate of polyp growth and possibly retard polyp formation entirely. So one aspirin a day, one aspirin every other day is probably going to be considered helpful as well.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I thank you very much for giving us some of your time.
You're welcome.
Our guest here this morning in the Sparta Focus 580, Dr. Claudia Nugent. She's a gastroenterologist. She works at Christie Clinic. The broadcast today is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information is available on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com. That's it for us here on Focus. Just before we go, a quick reminder that tomorrow, on Monday, a little change in the schedule, something a little bit unusual. We'll have two of our regular guests on the program on the same day. In the first hour of the show, Hank Spiess will be here to take your questions on home maintenance, and it is his regular appearance. And then we're also going to talk in the second hour with Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist, and she is on the program also once a month, also on a Monday, but she's showing up 1 week early. So you'll get them both in one day, and we certainly would welcome whatever questions that you would have. We're here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and of course we welcome your questions and comments. Right now we want you to stay tuned, because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine, the host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll go back in time to the Gilded Age for a story about two founding fathers of American industry, their partnership, and the reason for their estrangement, a bloody steelworkers' strike. Our guest at 106 will be writer and broadcaster Les Standiford, author of Meet You in Hell, Andrew Carnegie, Henry Clay Frick, and the Bitter Partnership That Transformed America. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. September wheat trading at 349, that up 4.5. September corn, 255.25, up 4.75. December, 264.75, up 3. March, 269, up 1.75. March corn, that's on there twice on the screen. So March corn again, 269, up 1.75. August soybeans, 725.5, up 5.5.